From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we discover what many dog walkers in New York's Upper East Side have in common.
I don't know many Brazilians, but I know they took over this area, I think.
We look into why the number of kids crossing the U.S.-Mexico border alone has almost doubled over the past year.
There have been cases of babies being brought into court in other people's arms. These are babies abandoned by the smuggler and being expected to represent themselves before an immigration judge.
And one man's love for a natural element most of us rarely even notice.
You put a kite line in your hands, you transfer whatever's happening 100 feet up in the air to your hands, so you're able to feel the force of the wind.
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us.
We are outraged that the federal government is overstepping what New York State said very clearly last year, that we do not want secure communities in the city or this state.
That was New York State Senator Gustavo Rivera speaking in front of City Hall on May 15th. It was the day before a federal immigration enforcement program that the state had fought against went into effect. Secure Communities Program requires local police to turn over information on people they arrest to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn also opposes the federal program.
They make it clear that Secure Communities takes a dragnet approach and that its implementation leads to the deportation of too many immigrants who pose no public safety threat to the city or state of New York or to our country at all.
Lucia Gomez Jimenez is the executive director of La Fuentes, New York and Long Island Civic Participation Project. It's an organization that focuses on immigrant and workers' rights issues. She joins us now here in New York to talk about the current implementation of Secure Communities and its impact on the state. Welcome to Latino USA, Lucia.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So simplify, if you can. It's complicated, but simplify exactly what the federal Secure Communities program means now for New York State residents.
So the state of New York was not actively participating in all counties of the state. Now it will begin to be participating in absolutely every single county of the state of New York, even after the suspension by Governor Cuomo last year. Anyone who's arrested and fingerprinted will now be processed by local law enforcement, sent to the FBI, and this information will then be checked with ICE. And the reality is that anybody that at that point is caught in that system will actually be potentially on the rolls for deportation if that issue actually arises through ICE.
Is the issue, because I'm sure there are some people who are hearing this who are going to say, all right, well, wait a second. If a person is being arrested and they turned out to be an immigrant and they turned out to be here without papers, isn't this person a criminal who should, in fact, not be in this country?
No. I mean, immigration issues, whether or not a person has overstayed their visa, whether or not a person is got here undocumented, it is not a criminal issue under the different, you know, law codes in this country. Therefore, just by the sake of being undocumented should not trigger any kind of potential deportation alone in relationship to a criminal arrest.
So why were the states fighting against this implementation of the program?
Well, there was a lot of uncertainty and there was a lot of confusion as to what the federal government was telling local states what they could do. I remember that in the state of New York, the agreement between the state and the federal government was that any jurisdiction who chose to opt out of the program was the reality, all local enforcement agents had to opt into the program versus in other states, everybody was in until they chose to opt out. Well, as soon as the federal government started noticing that folks were not quite rolling with the punches with them, they indicated, well, you know what? We don't need to have this type of memorandum of agreement with every state. You have to do it. And so it became an obligatory type of program versus something that every state had to agree on. New York City in particular has been a safe haven community where immigrants feel comfortable, and it's worked for our economy, and it's worked for our neighborhoods, and it's worked for public safety. For the federal government now to try to impose that upon a place like New York City, other places throughout the state of New York, really goes against the grain of what makes New York, New York.
According to a report released by Immigration Customs Enforcement last month, more than half, 55% of the people deported through Secure Communities in 2011 were convicted of felonies or of misdemeanors. So is the program targeting the right people then?
I don't think it is. I mean, I still, you're saying 55%, and you still have a large growing number of 26, 27% of people that had never committed any crime other than having to try to come into this country to live a better life. And that in and of itself is not a crime. A lot of things in terms of the way that our communities live in society as a whole, like drugs and like the infestation of many poverty type of issues that are really caught in that web of crime, are now being considered issues for why people are going to be deported. And I think that that's not the right way to go.
All right, Lucia Gomez, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Lucia Gomez Jimenez is the executive director of La Fuentes New York and Long Island Civic Participation Project. She spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York. And for news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter. We are LatinoUSA, all one word. And we're back in 30 seconds, 30 segundos. Stay with us. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. There are over 8 million people in New York City, and sometimes it seems like all of them own dogs. So in a city where any task can be outsourced, walking these pets daily is big business. Reporter Matt Draper brings us a story of one group of New Yorkers who's decided to go to the dogs.
It's an overcast afternoon on the sidewalks of Manhattan's Upper East Side.
What? Hey, Griffin. Sadie.
That's Sadie the Havanese and Griffin the Brussels Griffin, two of the many purebred dogs in the neighborhood. They're walking with Carol Franca, who moved from Brazil to New York 7 years ago. She followed dozens of her compatriots into the dog walking business, a service Brazilians have come to dominate.
I have a friend in Brazil who knew that I like animals, and then he knew that there was a dog walk company hiring. And then I think I worked for her company for 3 years. And then after that, I just left on my own and decided walking dogs on my own.
Franca is 33 years old, has short dark hair, sleeve tattoos, and wears a camouflage backpack with the Brazilian Soccer Federation logo. She says soon after she started walking dogs, she began meeting other Brazilians on her route.
And during the World Cup, I think 2006, I started noticing that every single person that had dogs, a pack of dogs, was wearing a Brazilian jersey. It's like, what? Everybody's Brazilians. I don't know many Brazilians, but I know they took over this area, I think.
Franca says she runs into Brazilian dog walkers every day. And shortly after she says that, we cross paths with William da Costa. Da Costa, who moved from Brazil 8 years ago, is walking a dozen large dogs with the help of two assistants, both Brazilian. And about 30 minutes later, we stumble upon a pack of smaller pooches led by another familiar dog walker.
My name is Carlos Ribeiro. I'm a dog walker for 15 years. I have a business, Dogs, Cats & Company, on 82nd Street. And then I love what I do.
Rubiero is a 40-year-old carioca, a native from Rio de Janeiro. He inherited his business from a friend.
My friend, he started to walk the dogs, and then after a while, you know, he decided to give up the business. And then he went back to Brazil, and he asked me, could you walk three dogs? I said, yes, why not?
Rubiero is something of an industry pioneer, having been dog walking for 15 years. He estimates that as many as 60 Brazilians work on the Upper East Side alone. He holds up his cell phone and scrolls through a contact list that includes more than 100 dog walkers, many of whom have Portuguese-sounding names. Rubiero said nearly all of them broke into the field via informal networking.
It's difficult for them not to get a job, you know, a normal job, you know. This is a private service. You don't need a paper or anything to work with. And then they just hire. Huh. It's simple.
Brazilian immigrants to the U.S. have not been studied as much as other Latin American communities, because census categories don't single out Brazilians, Figures for the population living in the U.S. are far from exact, but those who have studied them say they tend to work in the service economy in jobs such as domestic work. Dog walking is an extension of that.
Verushka, Verushka, Gus, Calvin, Daisy, Dewey, Bramble, Oliver, Mr. Roscoe, and this one is new dog, Lucas.
Phil Sosa is a typical example of Brazilian immigrants who switch from more grueling service industry jobs to the more relaxing conditions associated with dog walking.
I used to be a restaurant chef before, and then you know, I get tired. You know, people, restaurant, complain, crying, noisy. The heat from the kitchen, and outside is nice. You know, talk to the people, be outside all day. I work base. I walking is for my health, like 8 hours a day.
Poop scooping aside, walkers say they like their work, and they earn as much as $25 per dog per hour. But for the dog walkers we talk to, the best part of the job is their real clients.
I don't deal with people. I deal with dogs. I love that. They don't talk.
For Latino USA, I'm Matt Draper in New York.
Every year, thousands of unaccompanied minors cross the U.S.-Mexico border. Most come to reunite with their parents who are already in the U.S. But in recent months, the number of youth detained at the border has increased dramatically. This spring, the Department of Health and Human Services reported that between October 2011 and March of this year, the number of minors arriving alone in the U.S. almost doubled. Some 1,400 young people were picked up in just a single month in March. Sonia Nazario is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and a journalist who has been following this situation closely. Sonia, it's good to have you back on Latino USA.
I'm delighted to be here, Maria.
So, Sonia, a few years ago, you wrote the wonderful book, Enrique's Journey, the story of a Honduran boy who makes his way through Central America and Mexico alone in search for his mother in the United States. Now, fast forward to the fact that you wrote that book how many years ago now?
Well, the book came out in 2006, but the issue is very much alive and growing, unfortunately.
Right. And so you recently visited detention centers for kids in Phoenix, and you talked to the kids who entered the country without permission. So what's changed from 2006 to now, except for the fact that it's gotten worse?
Well, I think a variety of things have changed that are fueling this doubling of the numbers. They're expecting 14,000 children to be held from largely from Central America. And then if the numbers keep going the way they are from Mexico, an additional 16,000 from there. So 30,000 children coming to this country without a parent, without an adult with them. And what's really changed since I started looking at this is, first of all, I think the violence in the home countries with organized crime and the rise of gangs and gangs just controlling those societies and the Zetas controlling those societies as drugs move through those countries to the United States. So 13 and 14-year-old boys are being forcibly tattooed with the gangs 18th Street or the Zetas, the Z, and being told, you know, you will work for us or we'll kill your family. And so that's a huge issue in some of these Central American countries. Rampant poverty and lack of jobs, it's gotten worse in these places. A 2011 law in Mexico makes it easier for Central American children to traverse that country, at least through Chiapas, where it's being largely applied. And so word has filtered back to the smugglers, and they're using that to convince more parents to send their children north.
But let me interrupt you for a second, Sonia, because, you know, I'm sure there are people who are listening to this who are saying, wait a second, these are parents. They're allowing their kids, their teens, or their 10, 11, 12-year-old kids, boys and girls, to make this journey alone? That seems incredibly irresponsible.
One thing that's really affected the numbers is that the parents who come here always come here thinking they're going to go back quickly and or that they can go back and forth and visit their children. But with increased border enforcement, we've virtually sealed those parents in. It's gotten more difficult to come and go, and it's gotten more expensive to pay the smuggler. So they decide they're going to stay, and as a result, they bring up their children, children that they might not have otherwise brought up. But these aren't just kids coming to see their parents or to reunify with parents. They're fleeing abuse, neglect, forced gang recruitment. It's an exodus, but it's for a variety of reasons.
So what we do know is the numbers of kids who are intercepted, who are held in better situations now than, for example, let's say 10 years ago. But what do we know about the kids who actually don't get caught by immigration officials?
Well, it's thought that the majority are not caught entering the United States. And for those, you know, they're usually coming with a smuggler and they're delivered to a parent. They're held at a secure home. And sometimes they try to get more money from the parents than the parents originally agreed to. But they're usually released to a parent or an adult or a relative. For the kids who are caught, the authorities in the United States try to find a parent, an adult, a sibling, someone who can sponsor that child and they can be basically released to. And then that child is to go to immigration court and they should see whether they are allowed to stay in this country or not. What's really terrible about that is that these thousands and thousands of children, most of them go before an immigration court judge with no attorney present. I went to Los Angeles court, this was a while ago, but saw a 7-year-old child. These children brought in, chained to one another at the hands and legs, and expected to represent themselves before this judge. There have been cases of babies being brought into court in other people's arms. These are babies abandoned by the smuggler and being expected to represent themselves before an immigration judge. And the reality is that 40% of these children coming here alone have some pathway to legalize in this country, whether it's asylum or a special immigrant juvenile status, and yet only half of them are going to court with an attorney present. It's really a travesty. It's something that should not be happening here.
So, Sonia, you've been covering this story for a long time. Give us a sense of what needs to happen in order to put a stop to this situation altogether.
I think ultimately what has to happen is that we as a country have to promote trade policies and other policies that try to lift up the economies of these 3 or 4 countries that are sending 80% of the people coming here without permission. We need to help create more jobs in these places so that these parents don't feel like they have to leave in order to feed their children. And then many of these children follow their parents. And so I think we need a foreign policy centered around the issue of creating jobs in these handful of countries. We spend a lot of money at a variety of things to try to slow this flow, but ultimately, I think that's the only thing that's going to slow this flow of adults and the children who often follow them.
Sonia, thank you so much for joining us again on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria.
Sonia Nazario is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Enrique's Journey, a national bestseller that's been adopted by more than 50 universities across the country. Coming up, one man connects to the wind from the end of a string.
It's something that you don't see. I mean, when you see it, it's because it's hitting the trees and moving leaves.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. Thank you. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now, as part of our series, Radio Nature, about Latinos connecting to nature in powerful ways, we meet a man devoted to a mostly invisible part of the natural world. José Sainz manipulates the wind, toys with it, and is always humbled by it. Sainz designs, sews, and flies kites. Producer Jocelyn Frank visited Sainz in San Diego and brings us this story.
Well, the garage is my workshop. It's real messy. I just collect a lot of stuff. And these are the travel cases that are actually for golf clubs. So all of these have kites in them. So this is about 20 years of just collecting items, wind related. Just cut a little piece of this. A lot of my ability to sew, I think I got just from watching my mom sew. She was a seamstress when I was growing up. She used to do bridal gowns and formals, and I used to stand next to her and watch her do it. I think that's what helped. Now, this is actually a local park here in Hilltop Park. It's a place where I like to go and just fly my kites when I just want to go relax. Here we go. This is a really nice community park. There's somebody flying a kite, actually. How's the wind? For me, I have always have respect for the wind, the strength of the wind. It's something that you don't see. I mean, when you see it, it's because it's hitting the trees and moving leaves. But you put a kite line in your hands, you transfer whatever is happening 100 feet up in the air to your hands through the string. So you're able to feel it, feel the force of the wind. My brother has a ranch down in Baja in Mexico, and it's up in the high desert, low mountain area. One of the things that I always like to do is go up as high as I could on the mountain and lay down on a rock and just listen to the wind. And I would close my eyes and I can actually hear the wind rivers, I called it, that would move across the different canyons. Maybe that's the reason why I like the wind. And I understand it, I think, maybe a little better. The enjoyment that I get is from putting together the kite and developing the color scheme and working it together. And as it goes together, I see the colors appear. And then when I fly it, that's where I enjoy the most of it. So this one's ready to go. I guess we can get some wind. The tail's about 35 feet long. The kite itself is about, from bottom to top, 6 feet tall. About 2 months ago, a kite flyer friend of mine, he got into paragliding. Took me up on a tandem. I still think the wind is smarter than I am, so we were actually towed up and then released, and we were able to float around and catch some thermals and go even higher. I don't know if I'll ever do it on my own, maybe because I still have the fear of heights. So it really was, for me, it was a realization of what it must feel like to be a kite and what I imagine when I'm looking up at the kite that he's looking at. So you can see right now I'm letting it go and it's dropping in heights, but as soon as I stop, then the kite will begin to rise against the wind. I think about painting the sky and it goes higher and higher.
José Sainz kites. Writer Carlos Fuentes was born in Panama, spent his childhood in Washington, D.C., and will be buried in Paris. But he was decidedly Mexican. Fuentes was part of the so-called Latin American literary boom of the 1960s. He wrote prolifically, novels, essays, plays, commentaries, up until the very end. When he died on May 15th, two new works were being prepared for publication in June. One, a collection of essays called Personas, the other, a novel called Federico en su Balcón, about the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. We remember him as a significant writer of the Americas by reading this passage from This, I Believe, An A to Z of a Life.
Love, whether it is will or habit, generosity or imperfection, beauty and plenitude, intimacy and separation, is a human act that pays, as do all human acts, the price of finality. If we make love the worthiest goal and most worthwhile pleasure of our lives, it is because in order for it to exist at all, or perhaps because it does in fact exist, we must envision it as limitless, precisely because it is so fatally limited. Love can only conceive of itself without limit. At the same time, lovers know that their love has limits, even if they're blinded by passion and deny this. If not in life, then surely in the death that is, according to Bataille, the empire of true eroticism. The perpetuation of a love more intense in the mortal absence of the beloved. Kathy and Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights, Pedro Páramo and Susana San Juan in Juan Rulfo's novel Pedro Páramo. But in life itself, can even the most absolute, abundant love ever fully satisfy us? Don't we always want more? If we were infinite, we would be God, the poet tells us. But we want, at the very least, to love infinitely, for this is our only possible brush with divinity. It is our gaze of farewell and our gaze upon God. Dios y adiós.
And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you've got any comments or suggestions, call our listener line. It's 646-571-1228. That's 646-571-1228. Go old school and call us and say your name clearly and tell us where you're calling from. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, and Michael Jones. This week, we had additional engineering by Michael Johnson and Manoli Wetherill at NPR New York. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, and the Grantham Foundation, for the protection of the environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.